Our scripture reading this morning comes from 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 10. As you come to him, a living stone rejected by men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious, you yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house, to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For it stands in Scripture, "Behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a cornerstone, chosen and precious, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame." So the honor is for you who believe, but for those who do not believe, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling, and a rock of offense. They stumble because they disobey the word, as they were destined to do. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. This is the word of the Lord. Well, good morning again. My name is Tim. This is my second week here at Fairview. And I am, again, just really excited to be here. The main reasons that Jenny and I are really excited to be here are first, because we believe that God has called us to this place and this congregation. And secondly, because we really like you all, and you have been so welcoming and hospitable, and it's been a great couple of weeks. But probably the third reason is because I'm really excited to be this close to Philadelphia, especially because I feel like the Rocky film franchise had such a pivotal role in my life. I feel like Rocky helped raise me. He's a strange uncle of mine. But I really feel like those movies were really important to me, all of them except for Rocky V, which I don't admit actually happened. I know a lot of you probably have your own rankings for the different movies, but the one I want to talk about this morning is Rocky IV, which I think is really underrated. If you don't remember Rocky IV, if you haven't seen it, I'm sorry, I'm going to spoil part of it for you, but it's been like 20 or 30 years, so I don't feel that guilty. Apollo Creed dies in an exhibition fight against Ivan Drago, and Rocky has to go to Russia to get revenge. And this movie has everything. It's got James Brown singing Living in America. It's got a great training scene where he runs through the snow with a tree on his back and climbs a mountain. It has a robotic friend for Pauly for some reason. And at the end, Rocky basically ends the Cold War by himself. It's a great movie. But one of my favorite things about this movie is just how they created this perfect bad guy. And Ivan Drago, his signature quote to Rocky is, "I must break you." That was his entire purpose. It was his entire identity. And it's what makes great bad guys in action movies. You have to be able to tell everything about their character from as few words as possible. In real life, it's a lot more complicated to figure out what our identity is or what our purpose is, but they are inextricably twined together. Last week, we talked about the household and how the undergirding message of that was that before Jesus, we did not belong to anyone or anywhere. But because of Jesus, we do belong in the oikos, the household, the family of God. This week, our metaphors address a similar transformation. Without God, we have no purpose. But with God, we are living stones. We are a priestly kingdom. Last week was about belonging. This week is primarily about purpose and how we can derive that purpose from our identity in Christ. This morning I want to look at the stone metaphor and priestly kingdom to see first how Jesus Christ is a cornerstone for us, second, how his gospel can act as a stumbling block for others, and finally, how are we to live as a priestly kingdom. First, how Jesus Christ acts as a cornerstone for us. You know, this text uses a lot of Old Testament references and allusions. In seminary, they teach you how to categorize these different things. You have quotes, you have references, you have allusions and echoes, which are just very faint allusions. But that's really important because at times the Bible uses a lot of subtlety, and there's usually a reason for that. Here, Peter is the opposite of subtle. He's throwing quotes all over the place. It's very important for him to emphasize the connection with the Old Testament in order to show, one, that Christ is the fulfillment of these ancient ideas, and also how the Christian church, how you and I inherit the same access, the same responsibility, the same purpose that the Israelites had in the Old Testament. Peter draws from multiple texts with the stone imagery, the cornerstone, but I want to briefly touch on two of them, Isaiah 28 and Psalm 118. In verse 6 of our text, Peter quotes Isaiah 28, saying, "I am laying in Zion a stone, a cornerstone, chosen and precious, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame." In Isaiah, God is communicating that the promises made to the Israelites are placed on a firm foundation. This cornerstone, the Hebrew word means a stone of testing. It's kind of like a strength test, like when you go to buy like a case for your phone and said this has been tested, it drops up to 200 feet. That's what this stone is. It has been tested and proven to be reliable. It's a guarantee that trusting in this stone is not a bad decision. See, Jesus is this cornerstone that provides hope in the midst of despair, confidence in the midst of doubt, strength in the midst of weakness. We already know this, and I don't know if Clark knew what I was preaching on when he picked the hymns, but we sing about this all the time. A mighty fortress is our God is about how we can depend on Christ. Same with on Christ the solid rock I stand. We are familiar with how Jesus can be our cornerstone, how he can provide us security. The other reference for cornerstone in this text is a little bit more surprising. It's from Psalm 118, and it's used throughout the Bible. Jesus uses this psalm to describe himself in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Peter uses it here and to describe Jesus in Acts 4. And Paul referenced it in our scripture last weekend. But there's something a little bit different. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Stone was rejected. This word conveys intent. It's saying that the people saw the stone, they considered the stone, they considered Jesus, but after thinking about it, they decided to reject him. Just as the stone was rejected by the builders, so was Jesus rejected by the religious leaders who persecuted him. Karen Jobes is a professor and New Testament scholar who explained that Peter's audience had a personal stake in this. They were experiencing rejection by unbelievers that resulted in various trials and hardships. Peter explains that their misfortunes are not a sign that God is rejecting them, but are the very opposite, in fact. The various ways they are being rejected corresponds to the rejection that the living cornerstone has experienced, and it confirms their election as living stones in God's building program. So when we suffer, when we are rejected, we shouldn't see that as some sort of failure, but as a shared experience with Jesus, the living cornerstone who was rejected and did suffer. It's a way that we can participate and grow closer to the cornerstone. And I'm sure that the builders who rejected it expected it to fall into disuse, like most rejected materials. But the rejection that they assumed would lead to worthlessness instead led to Jesus being raised up by God to be both the cornerstone for us and a stumbling block for the world. It's the second point, how Christ can be a stumbling block for the world. You know, this language comes from Isaiah 8, which is the first place we can see this really, I think, kind of odd on its surface combination of a really positive image, the cornerstone, and a seemingly negative image, the stumbling block, right? Cornerstone seems positive, stumbling block seems negative. At the same time, Jesus is acting both as a cornerstone for salvation and the stone which people rebel against. The word here translated as stumbling, it can mean something accidental, like you might stub your toe and trip over, but usually it means something intentional. Most scholars agree that this text shows a stumbling because of a rebellion, because they do not want to submit to God's lordship. And I think it's really important to see that in the text, it's not saying that these are two different aspects of God. It's saying that the same thing that makes Jesus a cornerstone for us can make him a stumbling block for others. It's not two different effects. It's a single point that leads either to deeper trust or to rebellion. I came across this really beautiful explanation from a German theologian, but I can't pronounce his name, so I'm not going to try. But he said, in this encounter with him, each person is changed. One for salvation, another for destruction. One cannot simply step over Jesus to go on about the daily routine and pass him by to build a future. Whoever encounters him is inescapably changed through the encounter. Either you see and you become a living stone, or you stumble as a blind person over Christ and come to ruin. See, the stumbling means its own form of rejection. It means to take offense at the gospel, as it says in the text, and then stumble by not trusting in Jesus or following his lead. And I think if we think about it, there are many ways that people can stumble over Jesus, can stumble over the gospel. There's ways people can take offense at the bold and amazing claims of the gospel. You know, it's offensive in modern times to believe that Jesus is the only path to salvation. That can be offensive for people. It's offensive to believe that no matter how smart you are or how hard you work, you are incapable of saving yourself. It's offensive to believe that when you are experiencing tremendous loss or suffering, and you feel like there's nothing good in the world, that even in that moment, God is drawing you nearer to him. And this is why people often reject Christ, this is why they stumble over the cornerstone, because they take offense to the gospel, and at that point, it's an easier decision to walk away than it is to face the reality of our own flaws, our own limitations, our own isolation, our own sadness. But here's the real beauty in these metaphors. There is good news for the world, even in this text, even as we're reading about how they stumble over the cornerstone. There is hope for those who have stumbled, because God has a purpose for those who follow them. Back in verse 5, we read that you yourselves are like living stones being built up as a spiritual house, as a royal priesthood. It reminds me, this week, Dennis took me to visit Tel Hai, and I had the chance to sit down with Dorothy and Frida, and we were just spending some time together. At one point, they started questioning whether or not I really was from Virginia, because they said I didn't have much of an accent. They weren't sure of my story. And I told them, I might not have much of an accent, but I have been working really hard to limit my y'alls. I can't stop saying it, and I've been working really hard to contain it for the first few weeks and until you all really... That was an accidental one. And I say you all, just shorten it, until you get to know me. But it's really hard for me. I think it's really a pretty perfect word that everyone should use. To me, it sounds a lot better than, I think people, you say yuns, or like use guys is a thing. Okay. That does not sound as good, y'all. But it's actually really helpful to use a second person plural when you're studying the Bible. We don't have a universal one, in the States at least. And it's really important because when Peter is writing that you are like living stones that are becoming a spiritual oikos and royal priesthood, he's not saying you, Jim, are an oikos, or you, Valerie, are a royal priesthood. He's saying y'all. He's saying y'all. In the Western Church, we have this... a lot of people criticize the Western Church because we have a theological problem where we boil everything down to the individual level. We like to think about our personal relationship with Jesus, our personal belief system, our individual morality. But throughout the history of Christianity, the church has had a very communal aspect to it that we can't forget. See, when people stumble over Jesus, y'all are the support system to help them, because y'all are the living stones that are being built into a temple for the Lord to dwell in. Y'all are the priestly kingdom, the chosen race, the holy nation, the treasured possession that God is counting on to carry out a very important mission, an important purpose. See, this is our third point, our priestly purpose for the world. You know, this language comes from Exodus 19, and I love these two little verses, Exodus 19, 5-6. Actually, in seminary, I did a 30-page paper just on these two verses. If you will obey my voice and preserve my covenant, then you will be my treasured possession out of all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall become a priestly kingdom and a holy nation. And this is the key to the entire redemptive narrative in the Bible. You know, in the Old Testament, it shows God constantly attempting to reconcile his chosen people with himself. He saves them from the flood, from slavery, from the desert, from captivity, from evil rulers, from themselves. He shows up in the garden with Adam as a wrestler in the night, with Jacob in a burning bush, in a pillar of smoke, in a pillar of fire. God promises to save his people. And despite their constant failure, he tries again, because people are God's treasured possession. When I was working on this sermon, this point reminded me of a romantic comedy I saw a while ago, and I was like, oh, this might be a good illustration. And then I remembered that the movie is not very good, so I'm not actually recommending it, but I watch a lot of movies, not all of them are good. This one is called Leap Year, and it's maybe 10 years old or so, and it's about a woman who goes to Ireland because there's an Irish tradition, according to the movie, that during a leap year, it's socially acceptable for the woman to propose to the man. So she's been in this relationship for a long time. She's going to go to Ireland. She's going to find him. And then on February 29th, she's going to propose. But on the way, she meets this ruggedly handsome Irish guy who kind of changes everything. But there's this great line where the Irish guy says, you know, he asked her, if your house was on fire and you had 60 seconds to grab what you cared about most, what would you get? Later in the movie, she's at an apartment with her current boyfriend, and the fire alarm goes off, and he runs to grab his laptop, his phone, his wallet, his keys, and doesn't come looking for her, and she realizes that that relationship is over. Well, what this text is saying, what the Bible communicates, is that when the world is on fire, God goes to grab people. He goes to grab you. He goes to grab the royal priesthood, his chosen people, because that is what he cares about most. Peter uses this language not only to communicate that this church is a treasured possession previously used to identify the Israelites, but that this church now has the same tremendous responsibility, the same tremendous purpose that Israel failed to live up to. So what is this purpose? Now that we are a priestly kingdom built on the cornerstone of Jesus, what is our purpose? Priests in the priestly kingdom have three main purposes. First, to bring him praise. Second, to offer acceptable sacrifices. Third, to bless the world around them. First, to bring him praise. In verse 9, Peter writes that we are this royal priesthood so that we can proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness and into marvelous light. In Isaiah 43, we read that humans were created for God's glory. In fact, it's even in the Westminster Shorter Catechism, where it says that the chief end of man, the main purpose of man, of humanity, is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. That's the main reason we were created, to be reconciled with God, to be with him, and to bring him glory. This is why worship is so important. And while you and I, obviously, you know, we benefit from having this time together. We benefit from being together, from praising, from taking time to focus on God, from learning, from being conformed to his will for us. This time of worship is not primarily about us. It's about offering these praises to God. The second priestly purpose that we need to follow is to offer spiritual sacrifices. In the Old Testament, you know, the royal priesthood was confined just to descendants of Aaron. They were the only ones allowed access into the inner sanctum of the temple, and they were the ones responsible for offering acceptable sacrifices to God. We see this in verse 5, that now we are responsible for offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus. The New Testament has a lot of different things to say about what these spiritual sacrifices might be. It certainly includes praise and worship, as we can see in Hebrews 13. It also includes financial generosity, which we can read about in Philippians 4. Paul talks about it in Romans 12. He says that we are to present our bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. So here's what I believe the spiritual sacrifices are. This is a little bit taking from all these examples and looking at the Old Testament context for it. I believe that spiritual sacrifice means Just like money, worship, and our bodies, spiritual sacrifice means giving something up that we would rather keep for ourselves. That is what acceptable sacrifices are throughout the Bible. Even in the Old Testament, the value is not determined by the receiver, by God, but by the giver. Whatever that person does not want to give up, whatever is valuable to you, is what's a pleasing and acceptable sacrifice to God. Here's one kind of small example from my own life. I know that as a Christian and as a member of the priestly kingdom, I should love all of the other people who are created in the image of God. But there are some people I really do not like and I do not love, and I find that hard. And this was really difficult for me, and I think I was in college when I decided that, one of these things has to give. So I allowed myself a list of five people that I was allowed to not like or love at any given point in time. And then anytime I wanted to add someone to the list, then I had to let someone else off the list. And it ended up mostly being made up of friends of mine's ex-boyfriends and girlfriends. They stuck on the list. But it was very unhealthy because I was keeping this away from God. I was giving myself permission to act contrary to the priestly responsibility that God has charged us all with. So that's the second point, how spiritual sacrifices are that which we do not want to give up. Third, we have responsibility to bless others. You know, in Exodus, Israel was created to be a priesthood, not so that they could help themselves. They were a priesthood so that they could reflect God's glory to all the other nations. They were to be a testament, a city on a hill, an example for others, a mirror of God's glory, a proclamation to the world of God's power. See, the royal priesthood is not for the priests, but for those outside of the priesthood, for those outside of the kingdom. So how does your role as a member of the priestly kingdom bless those outside of your kingdom? I'd like for you to think about this week. How can you bless your job? How can you bless your neighbors? How can you bless your family? Are the non-Christians that you interact with on a regular basis, are they better for having interacted with you? That is a charge. That is a part of the priestly purpose that God has called us to. So in conclusion, the stone metaphor shows us that Jesus Christ is this stone rejected by builders, raised up by God to be both a cornerstone for us and a stumbling block for others. Peter tells us that we are ourselves living stones who, with Christ the cornerstone, make up a temple for the Lord to dwell in, and that we are now members of a priestly kingdom whom God cares for immeasurably, who he treasures, and he has tasked us with priestly duties. So this week, as we try to apply this metaphor to our lives, I just have two ideas. First, I want us to try and live as stones. I'm just assuming that at some point this week, you're going to be frustrated with something. You're going to be upset. Someone might cut you off, say something rude. Something could go wrong at work, or something in your home could break. Whatever that is, whenever you get upset or angry or frustrated, I want you to try and dig deep and remember that God has come to dwell within you. You are a living stone that God is living inside of, and that you are connected to the cornerstone of Jesus Christ. The second point of application is to how we can live as priests this week. You know, we talked about how spiritual sacrifice means giving up something that we'd rather not give up. This week, think about, pray over, what in your life are you holding on to? What part of your life is reserved for yourself? What are you trying to keep quarantined from God? It could be something related to worship, related to money, related to grudges, related to behaviors or addictions, familial relationships. It could be related to anything. But what sacrifices can you make this week? What can you give up to God that you've been holding on to for yourself? I want you to please try and live as stones and live as priests this week.